Hello, Capital Region. This is the Hudson Mohawk Magazine broadcasting from the Sanctuary for Independent Media in Troy, New York. I'm Michelle Masurgeon, broadcasting from a closet in my house.
And I'm Alexis Goldsmith. Up first on tonight's show, we talk to Philip Oswald. He's a lawyer who has filed a notice of intent to file suit against the Norlite incinerator, EPA, and DEC for the burning of toxic firefighting foam.
Then WOOC correspondent Megan Marone caught up with Capitol Hill Occupy protesters, or CHOP, in Seattle, Washington. We hear about their views on Black Lives Matter and their role in the Occupy protest.
And later on, HMM producer Anna Steltenkamp speaks with The Condor and the Eagle Films co-director Clement Guerra. This is part two of a two-part segment.
After that, Joffrey Roy Beauregard describes the natural and historical inspirations incorporated into the mural he painted on one of the sanctuary's Sixth Avenue buildings with HMM correspondent Spencer Keeble.
And we close out with Triple E's host H. Bosch Jr. as he completes his final segment speaking with Matt Toporowski, who is running for Albany DA, and Jeff Duskovich about needed prison reforms. But now for some headlines.
Senate Minority Leader Charles Schumer is calling for an independent investigation after the U.S. Attorney for the Southern District of New York left his post Saturday amid a public battle with Attorney General William Barr, who sought to remove him. The removal of U.S. Attorney Joffrey Berman has raised concerns among Democrats that it was done to protect President Donald Trump, whose associates Berman has investigated, including Rudolph Giuliani, the president's personal lawyer and a former New York City mayor.
The Times Union reports that New York has given the go-ahead for recreation like amusement and theme parks to open as part of Phase 4, presently planned for July 1st. Huck Finn's Playland in Albany has announced it is opening July 1st, but for now, malls, movie theaters, and gyms will not reopen during Phase 4. Robert F. Mujica Jr., the state's budget director, informed local leaders of the government's decision on Tuesday afternoon during a conference call.
Siena College plans to start its fall term with in-person instruction beginning August 24th, 2 weeks earlier than its original start date of September 8th. The fall term is slated to conclude November 25th, the college announced in a media release Monday. Many colleges are considering schedule changes to keep students at home from Thanksgiving through the new year, partly in an effort to mitigate the complications flu season is expected to have on the pandemic.
Temperatures at the Albany International Airport Monday topped 90 degrees for the third day in a row, marking the region's first official heat wave of the year, the National Weather Service said. Temperatures are expected to remain in the 80s for the rest of the week, with humidity levels dropping.
Residents of the Saratoga sites in Cohoes Public Housing Project have filed a notice of intent to sue against the Norlite Hazardous Waste Incinerator and the New York State Department of Environmental Conservation. The lawsuit relates to the burning of toxic firefighting foam, AFFF, at the facility. The city of Cohoes has enacted a one-year moratorium on the burning of AFFF. The state legislature also recently passed a bill to ban the burning of AFFF in Cohoes, though Governor Cuomo has indicated he plans to veto the bill.
The Capital Region's unemployment rate in May fell back into single digits to 9.6%, the State Labor Department reported Tuesday, from 12.6% in April. Although the figures are preliminary and aren't adjusted to account for seasonal variations.
The Times Union reports both campaigns for the Albany County District Attorney's race confirmed they had heard scattered reports of issues at polling places in the city on Tuesday. Democratic Election Commissioner Matthew Klein said it wasn't unusual to have some issues with polling places, machines, or workers.
Dr. Anthony Fauci told members of Congress on Tuesday during a hearing before the House Energy and Commerce Committee that the nation does not yet have the coronavirus under control and is seeing a, quote, disturbing surge, end quote, of infections in some parts of the country. As Americans ignore social distancing guidelines, states reopen without adequate plans for testing and lack of tracing the contacts of those who get sick.
For those of you just tuning in, you're listening to the Hudson Mohawk Magazine coming to you from the Sanctuary for Independent Media in Troy, New York.
To learn more about this program and how to support the Sanctuary for Independent Media, visit us online at mediasanctuary.org. And if you have comments, suggestions, or warm regards, email us at hmm@mediasanctuary.org. You can also follow us on Instagram or Twitter at Media Sanctuary and on Facebook at facebook.com/mediasanctuary.
Philip Oswald, on behalf of residents at Saratoga Sites Public Housing Project in Cohoes, has filed a notice of intent to file suit against Norlite Incinerator, the EPA, and DEC for the burning of toxic firefighting foam, or AFFF. We hear him speak with Mark Dunley for the Hudson Mohawk Radio Network.
We're talking with Philip Oswald, who's an attorney who, on behalf of some of the residents of Saratoga Heights near the Norlite garbage and Norlite incinerator, hazardous waste incinerator, has filed a notice of intent to sue EPA, Norlite, DEC, and the parent company, Trader B. Mr. Oswald, what has prompted this notice of intention to file a suit?
Well, I've been in contact with several residents at Saratoga Sites who are obviously very concerned about what's going on there, which I think they first discovered once the lawsuit was started by Sierra Club out in California, and then there was some testing done that kind of confirmed their suspicions. So we've been looking at ways that we can help them basically make sure that they have a safe place to live and to prevent any future contamination.
Now, at this point, the local community, City of Cohoes, has declared a moratorium, at least for a year, on the burning of AFFF, a toxic firefighting foam, is legislation pending on the governor's desk. That if he signs, which is not clear, would also ban this incineration. Isn't the moratorium sufficient, or what else are you trying to hope to get out of the litigation?
Well, you know, there has been some testing that has documented some contamination that has occurred. So we want that cleaned up again to make sure our people have a safe place to live. And we also want to make sure that it doesn't continue in the future. The moratorium certainly is a great first step. However, it does expire in a year. We don't know if the state legislation is going to be signed into law. I certainly hope that it does, and I would urge that it is signed. And hopefully that will take care of a lot of this with respect to the AFFF. You know, none of that, the legislation at least has not yet been signed. So it's still a problem that can occur in the future. And in fact, the DEC has said that they are going to do some testing to try and develop some protocols so they apparently can do it there at the future, incinerate AFFF at Norlite. So it's certainly a concern for the folks living in Saratoga Sites and then the larger community of Cohoes and Troy that this material is going to be continue to be, or there's a possibility that it will continue to be incinerated in the future.
So what are some of the, I guess, health concerns that residents are concerned about with the burning of AFFF?
Well, you know, basically, as my letter, which was sent out today, states, there's been some research that has linked some serious health conditions to PFAS exposure. PFAS is in AFFF. So primarily, you know, they're worried about those conditions resulting from the AFFF burning, at least. And a lot of these conditions can, of course, develop in the future, even though symptoms might not be manifesting yet.
You know, the Norlite incinerator has been operating for quite a few years. And, you know, residents over time have complained about other, you know, air and odor emission issues. Is this litigation only going to be looking at AFFF, or at some point may you expand it to look at some of the broader hazardous waste materials that are being burnt at this particular facility?
Well, I can't go into too much detail on that. I will say that we are investigating other hazardous waste incineration activities there other than AFFF. Right now, the letter that I sent out this morning, the litigation that would follow upon that letter would be limited to AFFF, pending, you know, what further we might find in an investigation. But right now, it's limited to AFFF.
So what at this point, what is the litigation hoping to accomplish? Are you looking just to make sure that this moratorium, in fact, you know, becomes permanent? Are you looking for damages, health studies of people who have been, you know, exposed to this? Or, you know, what are some of the remedies you're going to be seeking?
Well, two things again. One, we want an injunction prohibiting them from doing it in the future. And two, we want them to clean up what contamination we know to have occurred thus far.
So what's the, now I assume this is a, and perhaps incorrect, but I was assuming this is a lawsuit filed in state court. What's the process that now that you filed this notice of intent to sue, what happens, you know, in terms of timeline from here on out?
Well, the lawsuit would actually be filed in federal court. The letter, we have to wait 90 days after the letter was sent. The purpose of that 90-day waiting period is to give either the DEC or the EPA the opportunity to step in and bring an enforcement action themselves. But we have to wait 90 days. At the expiration of those 90 days, if the EPA or the DEC has not taken action, then we can commence our lawsuit.
You mentioned earlier that Sierra Club and Earth Justice had brought litigation about this and other facilities. Understand that may be mooted out about the Norlite facility because they are now canceled the Department of Defense contract. And yeah, the moratorium locally, but does this in any way dovetail or relate to the litigation that Sierra Club and Earth Justice have also filed?
Well, I think that litigation kind of brought a lot to light, and obviously it was very concerning, I think, for everyone to find out that one of the facilities where that contract would be carried out was right here in the Capital Region. But, you know, I think that this lawsuit is separate from that. We're seeking a separate, different kind of relief. It's a much more localized lawsuit seeking to protect the safety, health, and welfare of the citizens here. You know, I have heard that the contract was canceled. I first heard that a couple of weeks ago, probably, but, you know, I have yet to see any type of document from the DLA or Tradebe confirming that. But, you know, it seems to me that while the contract was canceled, there it is still possible, and actually I would say likely, that at some point in the future there could be a new contract. They still have a lot of this material that they need to get rid of, and, you know, it seems like they have been dead set on incinerating it at Norlite, among other facilities. So I think that the cancellation of the contract certainly is a positive step, but I don't think that it is enough to ensure that this doesn't happen again.
So are you hoping that other, you know, residents of the Saratoga sites may decide to join the lawsuit now that they know that you and some of the neighbors have joined a lawsuit, or are you pretty much set in terms of the number of plaintiffs you have at this point?
Well, so the lawsuit's being brought on behalf of an organization representing the community at Saratoga Sites. It's primarily consisted of Saratoga Sites residents. The more who want to join in, the better I feel. But I think we are trying to bring this lawsuit to make sure everybody who lives there has a safe place to live, has a safe place for their kids to play, regardless of whether you want to sign on or not. But we certainly welcome the more people who want to participate.
So we've been talking with Philip Oswald, who's representing residents at Saratoga Heights and across the street from North Heights, intend to file suit over the burning of AFFF. If people want to follow this litigation, how best should they do that at this point?
Anything that happens in actual litigation, if and when that is commenced, will be a matter of public record on the federal court system. It's called the PACER system, which does have public access. So you are able to access litigation documents that are filed in court. Those are public records. But again, that will not happen for at least 90 days from today.
Okay. Well, thank you very much, Philip Oswald. And this has been Mark Dunley for the Hudson Mohawk Radio Network.
Philip Oswald is a lawyer who has filed a notice of intent to file suit on behalf of residents at Saratoga Sites Public Housing Project in Cohoes. The suit is against the Norlite incinerator, EPA, and DEC for the burning of toxic firefighting foam.
The Capitol Hill Occupy protest in Seattle, Washington, was established by George Floyd protesters on June 8, 2020, after the Seattle Police Department vacated its East Precinct building. The goal of the establishment of the zone was originally six blocks, was to have a neighborhood without police. Protesters have demanded rent control, the reversal of gentrification, the abolition or defunding of police, funding of community health care, and releasing prisoners serving time for marijuana-related offenses or resisting arrest. This past week, WOOC correspondent Megan Marone caught up with protesters to interview them about their views on Black Lives Matter and their role in the Occupy protest.
Yeah, my name is Kay Wyatt II. I'm a local artist from Seattle, Washington.
How long do you think this can be held here in the Capitol Hill Autonomous Zone?
Police department is right up the street. They're not even helming the station right now. So this is going to continue, I think, until they feel like they've had enough and they want to take things back over. So, yeah.
Do you think that there's a chance that things could escalate between police and people here once there's a feeling of taking it down?
Most definitely. There's always the opportunity or that occurring when it comes to police, because that's one of the main reasons why we're here is police brutality. You know, they do things with impunity. And if they feel like they want to take it over, they're going to take it over by force. If they can kill a man unjustly for pretty much a simple stop or a small violation, for people occupying a space in which they're comfortable or they're supposed to be manning themselves, they're going to take it over by force. So, yeah, things could escalate into violence and tragedies. And so we just hope that never comes to that. It doesn't come to that. And we could probably come to a meaningful ground. This is all great too as well, but we need action. That's what we definitely need. This is great momentum, but we need to spur this into some type of action where the systemic changes start occurring on a broader level and more effective level.
So you identified yourself as an artist, a musician. Have you always considered yourself an activist? Or do you feel like we're all just living in this world where we are all activists? We're all on one side of this or we're not?
In one way or another, we are all activists because we believe in something. Your belief in whatever you believe in, you're going to be advocating for that. So whether that be social injustice, whether that be religion, whether that be love, whether that be hate, you're going to be an activist on some type of level if that's what you believe in. So yeah, I haven't always been an activist. You know, I have some things in my past that spurred me into being into the system for a long time. During that time is kind of when I, you know, began to change my idea and outlook on life and the value of human life. And so that's when I came out, I was like, I just want to be more of a positive being, you know, more so than I was, and just enjoy people and know that everybody has a story and we can all probably connect somehow. If we all told our stories, there can be a common ground somewhere where we can connect. So, you know, that's what pretty much led me to being an activist and, you know, wanting to create some type of change.
Having the video footage of George Floyd, everything happening in a condensed period of time, Breonna Taylor, Tony McDade. What's your feeling on why it was this that suddenly a lot of people are like, oh, okay?
I think now it's It's just more so timing, because COVID contributed to this, because we're pretty much all stagnant. We're dormant right now. We're all in our house, and a lot of people are on social media looking at things, and these things have been popping up on social media for years now. But I just think at this moment in time where, you know, we're separating it in close and confined to our house, people are dissecting it a little deeper now, and they're looking at it probably from a different perspective that they're not, because being removed from everybody, you're feeling that emptiness of wanting to spread love to people, and then when you see some hate like that, it makes you tap into, like, hold on, what's really going on here? What's really going on? So I think it's a culmination of COVID. And, you know, this has been happening. Like I said, it's been happening. It's not new. I've gotten beat up by the police myself. It wasn't on no smartphone or any apps. It was back when we didn't have no social media. I think also, though, white America has waken up to a certain degree. But my fear is that people are becoming prisoners of the moment, and they're kind of hiding their ideologies behind a movement that they know needs to be progressed. It's like they're hijacking Black Lives Matter just because it's something different and people are starting to rally behind it. But it's like, how much are you really willing to push this forward and get these changes in place where we don't have to do things like this anymore? You know, so yeah, I think it's just a combination of both. It's definitely a beautiful thing that people are, you know, waking up now, but I want to see action.
What do you say is the most inspiring thing that you've seen since you've been down here?
Just the vibe. It hasn't been like not one incident that I've seen. You know, people are getting along, and you know, people are spread love. It's a lot of love down here. So I think that's the most inspiring thing, is that, you know, behind everything that we go through, there is like that common thread that we can all connect to. And I think that's what everybody's doing up here on this Cap Hill. You know, hate that it had come to this, but you know, this can be a starting point to, you know, something brighter in our future.
Martin Luther King Jr. talked about his fear of moderates. And what you were saying, are we just going to go back to this moderate attitude?
Right.
They're giving away free food here, so to a certain extent, the systems that are being set up here, it's about usurping the economic system, you know? And that is related, obviously, to what happened.
Oh, major.
And what do you think about that in terms of the way that this is space to do that?
I think a lot of people here who are really here for the benefit of Black Lives Matter understand that the economic system or social injustice, you know, everything occurs through economics, the lack of options that we have in the Black community, as far as education, as far as job opportunities, the way we're targeted. Once we become criminals, we can no longer vote and things of that nature, the change, you know, all this stuff, the red line, it's a lot deeper than, so there is a lot of, the hidden agendas, I think, that need to be usurped, need to come to light more so, but people are here, they're showing what equality looks like, but it's just, you know, the people that are in power have to come to that realization as well. You know, it would be apropos if some of the individuals that were leading this started to become the leaders in those different offices, the legislation office, the Senate, in, where they can promote change to eliminate some of these injustices. Oh yeah.
Do you have any last thoughts of what you want to tell the world right now?
Yeah, you guys can follow me on Instagram at kwyatt_the2nd. You can check me out. Links in my bio with my music. Give me some comments and feedback too as well if you happen to listen to it, and I appreciate your support.
Thanks a lot for your time.
All right, thank you.
And you just heard WOOC correspondent Megan Marone reporting from the Capitol Hill Occupied protest in Seattle, speaking with protesters about their views on Black Lives Matter and their role in the Occupied protest.
For those of you just tuning in, I'm Michelle.
And I'm Alexis. This is the Hudson Mohawk Magazine on the Hudson Mohawk Radio Network, WOOC 105.3 FM Troy and WOOS 98.9 FM Schenectady.
To learn more about the Hudson Mohawk Magazine program, to listen online, and to learn how to support the Sanctuary for Independent Media, check us out online at mediasanctuary.org or get in touch with us through email at hmm@mediasanctuary.org.
HMM producer Anna Steltenkamp speaks with The Condor and the Eagle Films co-director Clement Guerra. In this segment, Clement speaks about his personal and creative journey through the production of The Condor and the Eagle and the implementation of the film's global impact campaign. Listen in to learn how an idea to create a 10-minute video led to a 2-year transcontinental journey documenting the global impact of 4 well-known indigenous leaders in the fight for climate justice.
I am Clément Guerra. This is obviously a French name with a very strong French accent. I am French. I live in Germany with my wife and my 2 babies. My wife's name is Sophie, and she's the co-director of the documentary film, The Condor and the Eagle. So we co-directed the film together. At the time, we had those 2 beautiful babies with us. Our 2 babies are 1 and 3 years old. So we are in the midst of a family storm, lots of noise and movement and smiles and laughter. And we are pretty busy because we are actively promoting a very impactful campaign around the film. So we are actually organizing 13 events that will happen on the span of 2 weeks. Jointly with key environmental groups, grassroots, and the Big Greens. And we are launching as well the film internationally on video on demand, VOD, on the 1st of July. So at the time, as I said, we didn't have those 2 babies, and we decided to hit the road or maybe cross the ocean, Atlantic Ocean, and go what's happening in the US about environmental issues, because we heard that crazy stuff were happening. We had never done a film, and we just wanted to learn more. We just had an idea of making a very short media work on environmental issues, not longer than 10 minutes. And we just ended up being on the road from Northern Canada down to the Amazon rainforest for 2 years.
Amazing. So what specifically was your driving mission at the start of production of The Condor and Eagle? And how did your experience filming alter or advance this mission? I know you just mentioned that the idea started off as a 10-minute short media piece and expanded to 2 years and transcontinental. So what part in the filming really transitioned your mission to this broader goal?
So first, the decision to make this film was a personal transition. We knew we wanted kids. We also knew that we were a very uneducated, immature people, you know, very privileged as well, living in Europe. And we knew that we had to take a step back, look at our lives from another perspective, and understand what means to be a human, and not only a human in our environment. I mean, the environment of habits and conditioning. So instead of buying a house, at the time I was an international marketing manager, actually. And we decided to take our savings and travel across the globe and go to the US. Our ideas were not very clear, but we just wanted to learn more about environmental issues going on there. And very quickly, we heard of the Cowboys and Indians Alliance, which was at the time an alliance between oppressed communities, indigenous communities, coming together, joining hands in solidarity to protect the land with the kids of the oppressors and the cowboys, those that actually expelled indigenous communities for their lands. So it was very interesting at the time to see that indigenous peoples were the actual leaders of what we call the climate justice movement globally. We had no idea about that. So it's been a very important learning curve, and it's been very exciting for us at the time and still, because not only the environmental problems or the environmental solution were to be found in science, in a rational, you know, like strategy thinking, but as well had a very important cultural component. So I have a master's degree in sociology and anthropology, and I was extremely pleased to see that culture was driving the movement towards an inclusive approach, and indigenous people, and especially indigenous women being the leaders. So what we decided to do was just rent a van, buy a cinema camera, and hit the road in a very small van. The ceiling was just, you know, like 30 centimeters away from our noses. That was pretty freaky at first, but we were crazy enough to just go for it. And we drove across the US, going from one community to the next, We would stop in the community. Indigenous people would tell us what their stories, what the issues were living, what they were putting in place to respond to those issues, what their lives were about, you know. We were just trying to listen deeply to what people had to say, whatever they had to say. And, this person would say, hey, drive 300 miles this direction and meet John. And John will know what to tell you about that. So that's what we did for a few months, crossing the U.S. from the East Coast to the West Coast. And we started working with in California, in San Francisco, with the Bay Area communities joining hands to stop the importation of tar sands coming from Canada. And so that's when we started, you know, really understanding that the tar sands were big issues. These were the largest oil development on the planet, the most polluting one as well. The one that shows that we are not working anymore with conventional oil, but with extreme fossil fuels. And people told us the same way, you know what, drive four days in a row all the way up to northern Canada, and there is this healing walk happening, led by indigenous people directly impacted by this crazy, crazy development. So that's what we did. And a few months had passed already, and we understood that the short pieces we were producing, the short videos, had something else to tell us. They connected a certain way. There was a bigger story to be told. And that's when we decided to make a film. So the film starts with the largest fossil fuel industry on the planet, the tar sands in Canada. And we decided to then choose, or maybe they chose us, the film protagonists that actually live alongside the oil pipelines in Canada and the US that are connected directly to the tar sands. The tar sands were huge, but they would become even bigger if the KXL pipeline, the Transcontinental pipeline, and other pipelines would be permitted and built, allowing the tar sands development projects to be increased in size by threefold. So if the pipelines were built and permitted, that would basically be a game over for climate change. So that's when we understood that there was like this very important story to be told. Little did we know at the time that the story wouldn't be about the tar sands, but would be about how indigenous communities and indigenous women are the true leaders of the global rise of the climate justice movement between the global north and the global south, between North America and South America.
Incredible. So you talk about this connection between North and South America. Based on your experience filming, what is the importance of connectivity and creating solidarity across political borders to gain efficient movement in the climate justice initiative?
Yeah, that's we could spend 2 or 3 hours speaking on that. All right. So, you know, I think the movement is for a more compassionate world, for activities that are not exploiting the natural world, that if it would be possible, resources that we can consume indefinitely. It's about respect, and it shows clearly that the problem comes from the hegemonic situation that we're given to corporations. Corporations don't give a damn about communities, about common goods. It doesn't care about sharing. It's about growing its own, my own interests, my own money, my own shareholders. And corporations, yeah, corporatocracy, somehow we can call it like that, has been wrecking the planet, destroying the planet on a very, very extensive level. We can notice that many big greens, or traditionally, many environmental groups have been led as well by privileged white people. Mm-hmm. And that have been kind of adopting corporations' ways to operate. So they are trying to grow themselves, following their own interests and making, you know, the environmental cause fit their own needs and their own self-interest. And what we have seen the past years with the environmental justice is that more and more, and we are not there yet, and that's why as well we are working so hard, is that impacted communities are actually taking the lead and decolonizing those organizations. It means that we need the work of those environmental groups, but we need them to recognize the natural leadership coming from impacted communities that know better what kind of solutions they need to the problems they face. You know, when people are comfortable with their way of life, they leave, and they don't really have a very clear interest in changing the way they are. So we hope that this film will actually educate the public, whether they are privileged or underprivileged, about some, like, how we can collaborate together, connect the groups, communities, and issues together, and gain a better, like, a big picture. So we're trying to connect the micro-local and the micro-global. And by following four key indigenous leaders coming from impacted communities, reaching out to the support of other communities across the continent, we show that impacts are not fate, that the feeling of isolation can be transcended, that we can go beyond feeling isolated and gain regional, national, international visibility, and that indigenous and impacted communities can use their voices in order to educate the larger public about environmental racism, about the importance to reconnect with the natural world.
We just heard Clement Guerra, co-director of The Condor and the Eagle, on Thursday, June 25th, the Sanctuary for Independent Media will have an online screening of the film and the accompanying Be the Media workshop titled Indigenous Voices, Media for Environmental Organizing. It's free and open to all.
You do have to pre-register for that event, though. Go to mediasanctuary.org or facebook.com/mediasanctuary. Up next, in part two of his summer recap, Joffe Roy Beauregard describes the natural and historical inspirations incorporated into the mural he painted on one of the sanctuary's Sixth Avenue buildings.
You were definitely able to expand on both of your science background and your art background. I heard you painted a beautiful mural on one of the sanctuary's buildings on 6th Ave across from the College City Garden. I just checked it out on the way here. It's awesome.
Oh, well, thanks, man. Yeah, well, that was also like a crazy experience for me. I had done like some kind of street art and like, large-scale painting, but never that kind of, that scale. Like, the painting is, I think, 35 feet long by 12 feet high, something like that. So it's like an entire level of the building.
So were you getting up on a ladder to complete that?
I had, like, some two levels of scaffolding.
Oh.
So, yeah, we had, like, I had the awesome trust by the sanctuary. Like, they trusted that I was going to be able to pull this off, and it was going to be nice, and I'm really, really thankful for that, because, yeah, it was a great opportunity for me to leave my mark there.
You definitely have, from Nature Lab to the mural, and more on the mural. So can you just describe it a little bit? It's at 3334 6th Street. Could you just describe it a little bit and some of your inspiration for creating it?
Yeah, for sure. So, the mural has like a lot of flora and fauna, so a lot of animals, plants, has some water, a sun, but all the elements basically are native species from Troy and the Hudson River estuary. So like all the animals, the plants are things that you can find growing naturally on the block, on the neighborhood. You'll have the birds I chose, the deer you can find just on the other side of the Hudson River. You'll have like the turtle, sturgeon, so a whole bunch of that.
I think the thing that struck me first when I saw it was how you have the two, like a human split in two, and on each side of the, and there's the animals are coming out of it. So what made you want to do that?
Well, I think like most of the art stuff I do as kind of the mission, I'd say, is to kind of reconnect people with their environment. Mm. Not always like the natural world. It could be like urban, or like in this case, I just thought, like, you know, I was kind of a visitor in Troy for 2.5 months, and I was by the river, and I walked a lot and biked a lot in the area, and like the nature was pretty vivid for such a urban area. Like, I saw animals all the time, and I think people kind of take it for granted or don't even like notice it, and I kind of wanted to, you know, make people realize that they're part of that, you know, they're just as much part of that environment, that everything that grows around them, and trying to, you know, draw a connection between all those other type of life form that we overlook often, and yeah, trying to recenter ourselves within that big that big thing. Yeah.
Well, your mural definitely has a powerful impact on those that see it, and along with the Nature Lab work that you did this summer, you're having a positive impact on Troy and trying to reconnect the people with their natural surroundings, whether it be their water and the animals and the land. So thanks for all you've done.
Yeah, well, thank you very much. I haven't talked about it, but like the mural, I included with the agreement of the like Mohican band, land acknowledgement. Mm. So a sentence that says that, like, when you stand on the Hudson River estuary where the water is never still, you have to remember that you stand on the Mohican land. So I thought it was important that not only the current people that are living around, but also like the initial stewards, that nature that still lives among us, are kind of celebrated and honored. So I was really honored that they accept my offer to include that. And, well, I hope they like it just as much as I enjoyed doing it. Yeah.
Well, that's great. I mean, with recognizing the history of where we are. So what actually inspired you to bring that Native American treaty into the mural that you created?
Well, I thought it went pretty much along the entire concept of, well, celebrating like nature and the environment, but like with the human being part of that big network and community, kind of like life form community. And I thought, like, well, indigenous people have a lot of like knowledge, and their like world vision implies a lot usually of recognizing that we are part of that network. And I don't want to generalize it too much, but I thought, like, the two human faces on the mural are kind of left, like, one is blue, one is orange. It's not really gendered, or I tried to make it as inclusive. So that everyone can kind of, yeah, inclusive, so that everyone can recognize itself into it. But I thought it was important to make sure that, you know, Native Americans feel that they also belong there, because, well, the colonial system has kind of clearly stated that they didn't add their place for so long. I felt like it was an important thing to reiterate and just claim. So yeah, I obviously, like, I was in contact with them to make the message approved and to make sure that they agreed with the whole thing. Like, I didn't want to do this on my own, obviously. So it was a really nice experience to get such a good feedback, like, for this. And, well, generally, like, while I was painting outside for approximately a week, everybody that was passing by had, like, good words, and they were super supportive. So it was really a good week for me. Like, I felt pretty good about it. Like, that
you did that in a week?
I think, Well, like maybe a week to prep the wall, like to prime it and clean the alley, and then I painted the thing in a week.
Wow.
So, yeah.
Yeah, it's awesome that you got the positive feedback from the community. I mean, it's a great message for everybody to reconnect, and how inclusive it is, and the history that it remembers. So thank you for doing that.
Yeah, well, thanks to you and to everyone that has, like, shown support. And I think especially when you're doing something that's going to be on the street that everybody's going to see for a while, you want to make sure that, like, the people that live next door to the thing are happy with it. You know, that's the most important thing for me, is that the community that is going to live with the piece just next door is feeling it. You know, and they're not they think that it's appropriate. And that was for sure, like, a little stress for me, because I did sketched and had it approved, but you don't know what, like, most people think, and you kind of, to me, it's like when you're doing, like, street art and that kind of stuff, with that kind of purpose of, like, spreading, like, a positive message and vibe, you want people to react positively to it, so it was a really good experience. Yeah.
Oh, definitely. Yeah. I mean, you did a great job. It's going to have a positive impact for a while, and we appreciate it.
We just heard HMM correspondent Spencer Keeble's interview with Geoffrey Roy Beauregard, an artist and a former 2019 Nature Lab intern.
And to close out the show, we have part three of a three-part series. Triple E's host H. Bosch Jr. continues his conversation with Matt Toporowski, the Albany District Attorney primary candidate, and Jeffrey Deskovich, who spent 16 years in prison, wrongfully convicted of murder and rape. In this segment, they discuss prison reforms for the elderly and impact of COVID-19, technical parole violations, and college education for prisoners.
Hello again, everyone, and welcome to another segment of the Triple E's, Education, Empowerment, and Entrepreneurship. Today's guest on the show is Jeff Deskovich, founder and CEO of the Deskovich Foundation for Criminal Justice and an internationally recognized advocate for criminal justice reform. And also we have today's guest is Matt Toporowski, Albany County candidate for district attorney. Welcome to the show, gentlemen.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah, thank you.
Great. So let me talk on this a little bit. Repassage Commission removing the exceptions to the law mandating police recording, interrogation, and other wrongful conviction prevention legislation. All right. Jeff, speak to that real briefly, then I want to know Matt's position.
So I was one of the advocates, along with many others in New York, that we helped to pass the law mandating that the police videotape interrogations from beginning to end, in view of the fact that coerced false confessions have been caused a wrongful conviction of 25% of DNA proven wrongful convictions. The bill was passed. The problem is that it had exceptions to it. So the legislators, they made it that it was not mandatory. An exception to that rule mandating videotaping was second degree murder, sex offenses, and drug cases. So I'm in favor of removing those exceptions, because the obvious question is, in which of those type of cases would it be acceptable to have a wrongful conviction caused by a coerced false confession?
Okay. And Matt, your thoughts?
I'm all about more to bring more fairness to the system, more transparency to the system that for far too long I think has been really calibrated to help those in power, you know, prosecutors and police. And so this is yet another progressive measure where we are making sure that the people with the most power are acting ethically, professionally, and we're holding them accountable. Because if there's videotaping everything that they do, we know that there's not going to be some, you know, backdoor, back room, coerced confessions and interrogations, which we know happen, which we know have led to wrongful convictions. And so I'm all about more transparency, and I'm certainly in favor of having videotaped interrogations.
Okay. Here's something else. I'm going to bump it to you, Jeff, and then I want to move it to Matt so people know where they stand. And we're just going to flow with this. Elderly prisoners who pose no threat to society being released.
With respect to releasing elderly prisoners, so while I was in prison, and I was there for 16 years, I saw a lot of elderly prisoners there who were hunched over, pushed around in wheelchairs, had debilitating illnesses that the prison, which already has bottom-of-the-barrel medical care, is even less equipped to deal with geriatrics. And there really was no constructive purpose to their being incarcerated. So, you know, a lot of them were there for serious crimes they committed 10, 15, 20, 30 years ago. I would like to see all those prisoners, you know, be released. You know, people that are just basically aged out of crime, they have medical problems which make them no threat, and or are in good, healthy condition, but have demonstrated that they've been rehabilitated.
All right, and then the COVID-19 and prisoners. Speak to that, both of you guys, all right? Start with you real quick, Jeff, because these are some quick hitters I want to get in.
So prisoners that have compromised immune systems that cannot fight off the COVID, there's no way to social distance in prison. So everyone like that who is no threat to society should be released, whether that's the elderly, whether that's people within 1 or 2 years of being in the parole board, people who are already over sentenced as nonviolent offenders. You know, the only responsible thing to do is to release as many prisoners as we can be safely be, you know, released to try to stop the spread of this.
Okay, Matt, going back to the elderly prisoners who pose no threat.
Yeah, well, I mean, you just said it. Sure, what we're having lately is that we're basically, you know, rolling people out of prisons in wheelchairs, and they've been there for far too long. You know, people have been rehabilitated or just served their time. I mean, I'm definitely in favor of moving to get our elderly out of prison. And like Jeff said, I mean, the COVID pandemic really highlighted this. And
moving to my next topic, technical parole violations, parolees being returned to prisons for things like being a few minutes late on curfew. And like I said, I want to start with you, Jeff, and roll it over to Matt, okay? Because being that you were incarcerated, you know the situation in and out of prison. So you know.
Exactly. So while I was in prison, I saw a lot of people come in and out of prison. It was like a revolving door. And sometimes I would come up to the people that I knew, and what are you doing back here again? And they would say, you know, and they would say silly things to me. They'd say that, I forgot to tell the parole officer that I changed address, or I was supposed to be inside at 9 o'clock, and I actually got there at 9:05. You know, and you know, they would be back in prison for 6 months, a year, sometimes as long as 2 years on silly technical parole violations. You know, as of like 4 or 5 years ago, it was $65,000 a year to incarcerate a prisoner. Now it's gone up. And to have people in there taking up that kind of money, whereas they could be free and paying into the tax base, you know, it makes no sense financially. There's no justice in that to me.
Okay. Matt, your position, because I want to get your position on all of these issues so people know.
Yeah, I mean, when we're talking about technical parole violations and probation violations, what you got to do is also zoom out. We're talking about mass incarceration here because, as Jeff said, and as we know, these technical violations, technical probation violations, it's another way to churn the system, to send people back into jails and prisons and just increase incarceration. It's been part of the problem of mass incarceration. So my position is these technical violations, we don't need to prosecute, okay? And because I've handled cases like this and I've had clients like this where what happens is they're late for a meeting. They show up late or they stayed out just a bit too late. The probation and parole officer takes those little violations. She or he puts them in their back pocket, and then they pop these people, you know, right before a holiday or a birthday or whatnot, and they send them to a jail or prison. And it really just churns the system, you know. And so mm-hmm. I've seen it used in a perverse manner, and I intend to stop that practice as the district attorney.
Great. Now, my next question is, anybody has taken advantage of this particular program, it's my good friend, Jeff. He just didn't sit there in that 6x9 cell and just dry up and wallow away. He took advantage of it. So college education for prisoners. Jeff, you are a living testament on how important that is.
I absolutely am. So while I was wrongfully imprisoned, I took advantage of the college program. I didn't just sit there idly. So I got an associate's degree in liberal arts, and I completed an additional year of schooling towards the bachelor's degree. And that really helped. And then at that point, funding was cut for college education.
Why was that?
Yeah, the rhetoric was, why should prisoners get a free education when I'm a law-abiding citizen and, you know, my kid has never broken the law and I can't afford to send him or her to college. So that was the rhetoric. And that was a false argument, first of all, because I went to school while in prison. I filled out the financial aid forms, the same FAFSA report. It's the same as somebody who was free would have to fill out. So nobody who would have been ineligible to go to college on a grant while free would suddenly have been allowed to do so simply because they were incarcerated. Do we want prisoners released who have quality education, who are equipped to get gainful employment, right, so that they can get a good job, and therefore the temptation to return back to their old ways, return to crime, return to what they know best, whether that's dealing drugs or committing robberies or burglars, we want them going back to that. Are they more likely, if they have the college education, to remain free, or someone that has no skills at all?
All right, you're a convicted felon. You can't get a job anyway. Let me play devil's advocate. So why am I going to spend all that money on your education? You're going to come out and the box when you check and say you're a convicted felon. I spent $50,000 on education. And you still can't get a job. Address
yeah,
that.
So, yeah. So the answer is that there are places that will still hire people who've been incarcerated. But obviously, you have to meet a certain level of skill set. Even if they're patient and give you some on-the-job training, you have to have some baseline skills. And so, if you don't have the college education for prison, you're less likely to meet that. That's one thing. Secondly, there is a movement to ban the box so that people don't have to disclose their criminal records on the front end. So that's part of preventing discrimination. My last point is that as a country, we have a 68% recidivism rate in this country, whereas Hudson Link, which is a nonprofit that provides college education to prisoners in some facilities, they have a 2% recidivism rate. So the college education, if you want to look at it, it saves us money in the long run. And a lot of people who have gone to college while in prison, when they return back to society, a lot of them are in doing give back type of work, working in the nonprofit sphere, et cetera, you know, working as counselors, diverting at-risk youth. They need to have that educational base to go with their personal experience to make those differences. If we're going to cut that off, we're cutting off our own supply chain.
Okay, Matt?
Yeah, I mean, I think that reentry for our formerly incarcerated people, reform, it starts from the inside out. You know, you can't wait till someone gets out of jail or prison to say, okay, here you go, we're going to start helping you. And so this goes along with making sure that people have the resources they need while they're incarcerated to educate themselves if they want. It goes to understanding that everybody has multiple chapters in life. Everybody's capable of change. I mean, you know, myself included, everybody. We've all had all these chapters in life. And so you have a couple of bad chapters, you make a mistake, you serve your time, thank you for serving your time. You know, welcome back to society, you know, and these labels like using convict, felon and whatnot, it's a shift in that, using that language. We're saying formerly incarcerated people. We're not saying convict or criminal, and we're welcoming these people back. And I think to make sure that our society is safer as a whole, that these people have the resources they need to come back and be productive members of society. And
thank you. Until next time, folks, don't hear about making a difference. You need to be about making a difference. This is Inez's Bosch's baby boy and your overcoming adversity specialist doing what I'm made to believe.
And that was Matt Toporowski, candidate for Albany District Attorney, and Jeffrey Deskovic speaking about prison reforms with Triple E's correspondent H. Bosch Jr. And that concludes our show. We hope you've enjoyed this episode of the Hudson Mohawk Magazine. I'm Michelle.
And I'm Alexis, co-host and COVID engineer. Remember that we're on every weekday, live at 6 and replaying at 7 a.m. and 9 a.m. the next day. You can also listen online through our Hudson Mohawk Magazine podcast and Facebook page. If you have comments or suggestions, email us at hmm@mediasanctuary.org.
As a reminder, the Hudson Mohawk Magazine is produced by local volunteers. If you're interested in helping with our radio effort, shoot us an email at info@mediasanctuary.org or join our weekly virtual Zoom meetings on Monday nights at 7:07 p.m. by sending us an email requesting an invitation link to hmm@mediasanctuary.org. Until next time, folks, thanks for tuning in.